Blog Talk Radio.
Suspense Radio. I want to apologize for a couple weeks ago when we had some technical difficulties. We found out it was the storms that were over in New Jersey where things are taking place with our electronical things, and so they were down for the time being. But now we're back up. We're ready to rock and roll. We have three fabulous guests on today. It's going to be kicked off with our good friend and fabulous author John Land with his next Blaine McCracken book, which should come out in December, called The Tenth Circle. Then we're going to have John Mulhall coming up after that with Getty's Moon. And the New York Times bestselling author for the first time on the show, Robin Cook, will be joining us around 11 o'clock. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. I'm your host, John Robb, and we are now going to hit Suspense Radio. Starts now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it.
I just want to get rid of the suspense right now and everybody know that the U.S. hockey team did lose the bronze medal game to Finland 5-0, so the last two games were not very suspenseful whatsoever. But here we go now with our good friend John Land, who is now back with his next Blaine McCracken novel called The Tenth Circle. He had big shoes to fill because his last Blaine McCracken novel, Pandora's Temple, did so well. The pressure was on, and boy, did he deliver. So, John, we want to welcome you to the show. How you doing?
You know, John, I love coming on first because I get the music. I mean, I get the get the intro. I get the theme. I feel really important when I'm the first guest.
It's kind of coming off of stage, raising your hand, saying, let's do it.
There you go. There you go.
So, again, so Blaine McCracken is back, The Tenth Circle. The book came out mid-December. Came out with fabulous reviews, and like I said, you had a lot of big shoes to fill because Pandora's Temple was such a great hit, was one of your strongest books, especially in the Blaine McCracken series, and now you came out with The Tenth Circle. Give us some background here on The Tenth Circle and, you know, kind of the inception of the book itself.
It's a good question because I wasn't planning to write it, but Pandora, because I had never, this whole thing of doing an ebook original that was primarily a digital platform was new to me. I had no idea what to expect, and on top of that, I was bringing back a character who I hadn't written about in 15 years, who was now 60 years old. So there were a lot of unknowns. There were a lot of variables. But the reception to McCracken, the reception to Pandora's Temple last year, 2012, was just so positive. I had a window of time, but I didn't have an idea for a book, but I had some concepts. One, I'd always wanted to do something about two of the greatest mysteries of all time. As all thriller fans know, the what-if question, often with a historical backdrop, in the famed thriller prologue, arguably invented by Robert Ludlum, perfected by Clive Cussler, expanded upon by Jim Rollins and Steve Berry, Brad Meltzer. So I always wanted to write about the Roanoke Colony, 1690, when all the colonists disappeared, vanished. To this day, no one knows what happened to them. And also, the greatest seagoing unsolved mystery of all time, arguably, the Mary Celeste, the ghost ship that was found floundering off the coast of of the Azores, Azorean Islands, back in 1872. Ship that the crew was gone. No one to this day knows what happened to them. So I had always wanted to play with those. That's what this is like for a thriller writer. Things like that are toys. They're like things we want to assemble. But instead of putting together, we have to solve the mystery. And the other thing, and this is even more important, John, I didn't have a concept for the book, but I had a thought. When that crazy Florida preacher, I think his name was Terry Mann, started burning Korans, Arab world, the whole Muslim world, caught fire. And what that proved to me, or what that illustrated to me, was that great villains didn't necessarily need to have great armies and resources behind them. That in the age we live in, anyone with an internet connection and a laptop can do incredible damage to the world, to society, to civilization. And that got me thinking, instead of putting Blaine McCracken up against a James Bond-like villain, what about putting McCracken up against someone whose villainy lies in their beliefs, lies in their paranoia, lies in their obsessive compulsion to hate? And what I figured out in the writing of this book was that hatred is worse than any weapon of mass destruction, because hatred is what spawns everything else. I had a blast writing the book. It wasn't easy because a lot of it, more than usual, was making it up as I went along, but I think the finished product really turned out great.
And, you know, that's one of the things that is very, very enticing about the book, is like the realism of the emotion of the villain, because he's not like the superhuman thing. It's basically built off of an inside kind of burning sensation that's just, like you said, just straight hate, which can be an extremely powerful emotion, just like fear can be extremely powerful emotion.
You're absolutely right. And the thing about the 10th circle that I really try to get to the heart of is not so much religion as cult. And that's what the Reverend Jeremiah Rule, the villain of the book, is. He's a cult figure. And I ask myself, you look at the Branch Davidians in Waco and the blind loyalty of following a whack job like David Koresh. You look at Jim Jones down in Guyana and who inspired 1,000 people to kill themselves. Well, the danger there is that it isn't so much the fanatic. It's the fact that there are followers for the fanatic. And that's dangerous. Because in this day and age, as our society in America becomes increasingly polarized, and the beliefs of some people become so out of the mainstream that you wonder if they even have brains, you wonder what they're thinking. But more important, you wonder what they're capable of. And I think what we have here, John, in society, as well as the thriller genre, is a kind of paradigm shift to the fact that villains are being redefined, what villains are capable of, and where they come from, how they develop, is being redefined. We saw this last year in real life in almost succeeding weeks. We saw this at the Boston Marathon bombing with the Tsarnaev brothers. We saw this in Cleveland with Ariel Castro, who kept three young women, first as girls, they were prisoners for 10 years. We don't want to believe, John, that the bad guy, we take comfort. Let me put it this way. We would like to take comfort in the fact that the monsters don't live near us. The monsters are somewhere else, and there'll be someone else who has to deal with the monsters. But what reality, as we saw last year, and what in fiction, what we see in the 10th circle, is the monsters no longer live apart from us. The monsters have moved in quite literally next door. And where the greatest threats we may face in the future come from are not – and let me give you another example. Edward Snowden, a man who's done incredible damage to this country, incredible damage. He doesn't even have a high school diploma. He's not a genius. He has no followers except his equally crazy whack job Glenn Grunwald from the Guardian over here in London. Obviously it's not hard to figure out how I feel about these things, but these people are a lot scarier in many ways than people who announce their intentions and are not shy to, you know, almost profligate their villainy. These men who are represented by the Reverend Jeremiah Rule. And what's great about this is, for me as a writer, a guy like McCracken, who's now 60 years old, who has been fighting bad guys since Vietnam, and he's been fighting all kinds of different bad guys. This is a new bad guy, a new kind of bad guy. And that breathes new life into an older hero and a series that is now 11 books in, that's been broken up over 15 years. It's just a blast trying to not think about what has already scared people and what has already hurt people, but what is going to scare people and what is going to hurt people. That's the fun of writing thrillers.
Yeah, I always go back to, and it might be, it's just always funny, the movie Addams Family Values, when they ask Wednesday what she's dressed like, and she goes, a serial killer, because they look like everybody else. It's just so true, because you could be standing next to somebody and you just don't know. But the one thing that I want to ask you is, because since, you know, you took some time off before you wrote Pandora's Temple, was there a pull for you to say, you know what, do I age Blaine McCracken, or do I kind of leave him younger and do more things? How much of a pull did you have with that? Because you could have easily left him younger. You didn't have to age him. So what was the mindset with that?
It was actually a very simple decision, because I think as a writer, you form a sacred bond with your readers. And your readers expect honesty, and they expect you expect to be not disingenuous with them. To do anything else for McCracken, to make believe he was still 45, even though he was a Vietnam hero, as a Green Beret, a special ops in those days, well, then he would have been 13 or 14 when he was in Vietnam. That's not right. I remember an interview with Robert Parker where he said the biggest mistake he ever made writing Spencer was making him a Korean War veteran, because that would mean Spencer had to be 85 years old by the time. That's how old Spencer is right now. It doesn't work. There is
right.
What I did was, John, and there's the precedent I used was the writer who has been one of the three or four most influential writers in my career, and that's reading the James Bond books by Ian Fleming when I was 12, 13 years old. I read them all one summer at summer camp, and I read them in order. And one thing I learned, and they're very short, by the way, they're all about 240 pages. There's not a lot of excess bulk to those books. But here's the thing. Bond aged in those books. He was an entirely different character in The Man with the Golden Gun, the last book Fleming wrote, than he was in Casino Royale, which was the first book Fleming wrote. An entirely different character. He was showing his age. He was showing the pain. And I wanted to stick to that model, because of all the series I've ever read, the James Bond series still resonates with me the most because of the honesty Fleming approached the series with. He had a character who was getting older, and I found that to be so unique today in comparison to today, where characters like Dirk Pitt tend not to ever change, not to ever evolve. They kind of get rebooted, but you can't follow them. And I'm doing the same thing, John. In my Caitlin Strong series, Female Texas Ranger, the great thing about those books is watching the kids grow up, is my hero in a familial situation. So she has to grow up in conjunction with these children she's become the surrogate mother of. And I think that makes for a remarkable thing, because the challenge is, and I know there's a lot of writers out there listening to the show, there always are, and here's the challenge we all face, and the writers must determine, why do we care about characters? We care about characters because we're emotionally vested in them. We're emotionally vested in the challenges they face. The great thing about McCracken at 60, especially in Pandora's Temple, is when the book opens, his phone has stopped ringing. Nobody calls them anymore. We've got SEAL Team 6. We've got Delta Force. None of these things existed when McCracken got into the game. They weren't around. So to watch him redefine himself emotionally in Pandora's Temple and then into the Tenth Circle, where he faces a spate of entirely new challenges, was really just a wonderful experience.
And what that ends up doing is it actually ends up growing you as an author, because you're kind of growing along with your character. Your books then become a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more, there's a lot more moving parts that have to go along with them. I mean, when you look back, just let's say, at the Alpha Deception and the Gamma option all the way back in Blainer Crack, and then you're moving forward, you have to kind of look back at those books and you look forward and say, not only has he grown, but I've grown as an author, and I think that's a very important thing that authors need to realize, that you will grow also with your characters and your storylines.
That's such a great point, and growth is so important. But the thing about growth as a writer is you can never. It's the old saying, you leave with the girl you brought to the dance, or you leave with the girl who brought you, and you've got to remember what people expect from you in a book, and they expect action, and they expect intrigue, and they expect excitement, and you can never get away from those things. You can never get away from the things that define you, because they're the things that people want to see when they read your books, that they're desperate to see when they read your books. And even though you grow and you change and you evolve, the pillars of who you are as an author, you always have to remember, I'm an action writer. I write books where I don't want, my goal is I don't want you to be able to put them down. That's what I care about. That's what I'm trying to accomplish. That's what I'm trying to achieve. And as long as I do that, everything else I do is better. But if I don't achieve that, nothing else I do matters.
Very interesting. I mean, that's very deep right there, too, for people listening. I mean, that's the one thing that you take such heart in when you look at your books and how the fans react. And the one thing that I've been asking a lot of authors recently is, now with the inception of social media, of course, which hasn't been around but very strong now in the past, 5-6 years probably, a lot bigger and going forward, now that you can get instantaneous information from your reader, somebody picks it up, reads it, they can post it right away, right when they're done, where before you couldn't get that. You had to wait. But now that you see what interests readers and what they're interested in, because you're getting all of that feedback right away, do you let that affect you as a writer when you're writing your next book, or do you kind of take any of that information within to you, knowing what the fans are kind of interested in when you're thinking about writing your next book?
It's very dangerous to let Amazon reviews and Facebook posts affect the way you determine what you want to do. Because if you're doing that, you're responding not to what's positive. Because what moves you to change is not what people are saying that's good. What moves you to change is when people are saying what's not working and what you're doing. It's actually a great question. And I do listen. I think you can learn something from anyone you speak to, any reviewer, any critic. There's always something you can learn. But if you try to change who you are every time you get a criticism, every time you get someone says something about what you're doing, then you're no longer being I mentioned the word, being genuine. The first person you have to be genuine with is yourself. You have to tell yourself the story before anybody else can read it. Because you're the first person that you have to please. You're the first person. And the other thing is, instead of listening to every internet reviewer, who comes along, and I'm lucky in the fact that most my internet reviews are overwhelmingly positive, knock on wood when I say that, I have a stable of people, editor led by my editor, Natalia Aponte, who also is the agent for my fiction. Natalia is a genius, and she's tough on me. You know, she says, I'm sorry to be mean, but dot, dot, dot. And I can't tell you how much better the 10th circle is than, you know, for instance, and I'll give you a perfect example. You know, okay. One of the things she said was, there's not enough, we're missing a few action scenes. Well, the most popular scene in the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but it takes place at a retirement home when you read it. That scene was not even in the book for the first two drafts, and it is overwhelmingly the most popular scene. When everybody says, you know, my favorite scene in the book is, and I go, the nursing home scene. And they go, yeah, how did you know? And I went, and I just smile, the retirement home scene, and because everyone else says the same thing. So the key thing, and this is a long way of a kind of a roundabout way of answering your question. The key thing is not you have to listen, but it's not that you listen, it's who you listen to. Who do you trust? Who knows your work? Who is reading your work and saying, here's what I think you're trying to do. Here's how you can do it better. You know, most people who slam me are not fans of the kind of books that I write. You know, they don't like the kind of books that, you know, and I'll give you another perfect example. Published this weekly review of Strong Rain Falling, the most recent Caitlin Strong book, raved about it. But the last line was the old but. But some, and it was, quote, but some readers may be irked by Land's constant reliance on cliffhangers. Well, what are thrillers but a collection of cliffhangers making you want to go on from? So the thing is, if I listen to Publishers Weekly, and by the way, they're usually very, you know, they said otherwise all good things. So I'm not criticizing Publishers Weekly. But if I took that advice, I would say, well, you know what? I really want to have cliffhanger chapter endings. I really want to have short chapters. That, you know, I'd rather have 110 short chapters than 50 long ones. But you know what? Somebody criticized me for it, so I'm just going to go back and I'm going to do what they told me instead of what I feel in my heart. No, when you start to compromise on your own principles, on your own creative nature that makes you a storyteller, you know, the 10th Circle I think has 101 chapters, and because it's but. What I like to do for this audience, because I think what you alluded to before about social media, it also has changed the way people read books. People read books today, they will, in the same way they watch television or send emails. They do them in splotches. So instead of having a chapter that has six different scenes in it that cuts away, what I do is I take those six scenes and make them all individual short chapters, because people that way know they're getting a change in place, a change in character, and most of them change in viewpoint when they get to a new chapter. It's very, very, it makes reading my books very comfortable. It makes it very easy. It's kind of like water, you know. And I know, and you know, I can be criticized for that, but that doesn't mean I should change that.
Right, there's no better feeling to know, and again, we're speaking here with John Land, and the book is The 10th Circle, it's the next Blaine McCracken novel. You also got Strong Rain Falling with Caitlin Strong, which had just come out. But the one thing that's good when you pick up a John Land novel, and of course your fans know this, but we want to get new readers to get involved with your books, is it's like that warm blanket on a cold night. You pick it up, it makes you feel comfortable, you know what you're going to get, and you're so happy that you got it, that it makes, you know, it gives you that warm feeling, and that's the one thing that readers, you know, need to know. That's what you're going to get, and that's what you deliver with them. And I think it's great that you stick with who you are.
And that's key. And we can learn that. Look, I've recently finished what I think is the most fun I've had with a book in years, and that is Stephen King's Doctor Sleep. Now, there's a guy who might be the most successful author in history, and here it is all these years later, and he finally writes a long-awaited sequel to The Shining, which is a formula for a letdown, for a disaster. And what does he do? He writes one of the best books he's ever written, a book that – and this is the point I want to get at. What I got from that book, John, is what I want to give the people who I'm lucky enough are going to pick up The 10th Circle or Strong Rain Falling or any of my books. And that is, when you put it down, you can't wait to get back to it to find out what's going to happen next. You are so scared for the fate of these characters, that you hate the villains so much and you love the heroes so much that they become, you become like a kid again. And that's what great storytelling, because that's what I am. I'm a storyteller. That's what all great writers are, storytellers. When you're a storyteller, you are taking an adult audience and making them feel like kids again. When I read Dr. Sleep, I felt like a kid again. And when people read The Tenth Circle, I want them to have that same joy that they had when they read books or when their parents read books out loud to them. I learned, people say, how did you learn how to write? And I give, there's a lot of answers to that question, no simple ones. But what I tell people is, I used to be, I was a summer camp counselor, great camp in Maine called Samoset, for years and years and years and years. And I learned how to write by telling stories around a campfire. And there were a lot of old Twilight Zones where I'd remember the setup and I'd remember the twist. But I wouldn't remember the middle, so I'd have to make up the middle, the names of the characters. You know, I tell Stephen King stories, same thing. When you are in front of your audience telling a story, you know immediately when you lose them. As writers, we don't have that luxury because the person is not in the room with us. But I've developed over the years, and actually this came very naturally to me, the ability to write my books as if the reader is sitting in front of me and I'm telling the story to them out loud. That's the effect I'm going for. I mentioned Natalia Ponte, my brilliant editor before. She gave me the best advice about writing I've had in years, just a few years ago. And she said, when writing a scene, always know where the light is coming from. And what I do when I write a scene is I build everything around that light to bring the scene to life visually, which is what you do as an oral storytelling tradition. And that's what I try to do in my books. I write very colloquial, in a very colloquial sense. Every scene I write is from a viewpoint of a character. You're seeing as the reader what they're seeing. And you're feeling what they're feeling. Everything comes down to emotion. To making you care. Dr. Sleep was a brilliant book because we care about the characters. More than anything, we care about these people. And that's and that's what I want people to take away when they read my stuff.
Well, we got about 20 seconds left, all right? So tell everybody what's coming up from you now.
I've got so much, I need 20 minutes, but... Next on the list, we've got Strong Darkness, Caitlin Strong, next fall, taking on the bad guys are Chinese. They're in Texas, and it's based on a tremendous amount of reality, which nobody realizes, that the Chinese built our 4G network, our 3G, you know, the 4G network that we all rely on for communication. That was built by the Chinese. And now they're building the 5G network, and they're planning very bad things. And that's where Strong Darkness out in October picks up. And, you know, some great twists and turns. And not to give too much away, John, but Caitlin Strong is going to shoot a few people.
No, that's good. That's what we like.
I know that shocks you.
That's the blanket I'm talking about. I know.
I know that shocks you that she guns a few bad guys down.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, it's always a pleasure having you on. We never have enough time to talk. We can go on for 2 hours and just keep going and educate the writers and the fans of the world exactly what's going on in the thriller genre. But thank you again so much for coming on, and we will talk with you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I always have a blast talking to you.
All right. Bye-bye, John.
Take care.
So, again, everybody, that is author John Land. You can go to johnlandbooks.com for a lot more information about the 10th Circle, all the Caitlin Strong books, and everything else that John has going on. He is an extremely busy man. And he's one of the authors that if you're a thriller reader and you don't have him on your bookshelf, then don't call yourself a thriller reader. A couple other things that we have going on here is Kara Voorhees' latest book, Men at Night, is now available through Amazon, with one reviewer saying, creepy, this is one of those intense must-read books. Voorhees has mastered the art of producing a spooky story. Next, you have New York Times bestselling author Jan Burke returns with Caught Red-Handed, e-short story collection featuring a brand new Irene Kelly short story. Because before Frank Harriman and Irene Kelly got married, Frank was a rookie cop in Bakersfield, California. When he investigates one of those worst types of calls a policeman can get, a bad smell coming from the closed trailer on a hot day. Frank and his training officer are not surprised to find a dead body, but everyone is stunned when the corpse leads to the police chief's downfall. So you can download Caught Red-Handed today for just $1.99. You can get it on Amazon. Author Adam Mintzner is back with A Case of Redemption. Suspense Magazine named Adam one of the best authors of 2012. So you can pick up a copy right now of A Case of Redemption today. We are going to be back on here real fast with our next guest. He is author John Mulhall. And in the meantime, don't miss out on Thriller Fest and listen to this.
It's time for a face-off where mystery meets suspense. Join us at the 9th annual Thriller Fest. Learn from top industry leaders and authors at Craft Fest. Get your story heard by industry professionals at Pitch Fest. Celebrate the new 2014 Thriller Master Scott Turow, along with 2013 Thriller Master Anne Rice, Silver Bullet winner Brenda Novak, and a list of special guests you'll have to see to believe. July 8th through the 12th at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, the premier conference for thriller enthusiasts, those who read them and those who write them. And find out about the new ITW anthology Face-Off, where the world's greatest thriller characters meet head-to-head in 11 electrifying stories. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
So again, everybody, we want to welcome you back here to the show, and we're going to bring on our next guest. He is author John Mulhall, and his book is called Getty's Moon. You can find John on the web at going to John Mulhall, MULHALL.com. So, John, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Again, I want to apologize for a couple weeks ago. We were a little bit technical problem. We found out that it was because of the storms in New Jersey, kind of screwed up some of the servers and had things messed up. So that's kind of why we were a little off. Thanks for rescheduling and coming back on. And again, your book is Getty's Moon. It's out. People can get it now. When they see the cover, the first thing they're going to notice, of course, is the skull looking dead at him. And they might sit there and go, whoa, 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 what exactly is this book about? Well, here's the good thing. Give them that taste of exactly what this book is about and let them know what they're getting into when they purchase Getty's Moon.
Yes. Well, I'd like to say that Getty's Moon is a supernatural thriller, and it's basically centers around this gentleman named Tyler, who starts the book with in a state of amnesia. He's lost his long-term memories, and he's traveling across the countryside. He is trying to kind of piece back to piece together his life, and he ends up in this small town called Getty's Moon. And it's a wheat farming town. He sets up kind of a temporary residence there, and he starts to make friends with the locals, starts to spend some time with the local librarian and her son. And as he starts to get closer to people, his memories start to bubble back to the surface, and none of them are particularly good. And he starts to think that maybe he forgot everything for a reason, and that just by remembering, he's brought danger with him to this small town.
And so, Tyler, you know, your character here, your main guy, why do you think that he was kind of one of the perfect ones to kind of fit himself, you know, into Getty's Moon? What made him so special? How, when you were creating, did you decide that he was going to be the one that was pretty much going to headline your book?
Well, it all kind of started, I took a course in college about, a psychology course for, it wasn't my major, it was just for credits, but I enjoyed it, and I took a couple. And we were talking at that time about something called psychogenic fugues, which I don't think they call them that anymore, but the idea of a fugue state where people were actually, in certain cases, deleting their entire past, their entire life, creating even in some cases false memories, false lives, and just kind of wandering. That's part of part of the symptoms of this is you wander. And I thought, of course, me coming at things from a slightly skewed perspective, I thought, what could be so traumatic in someone's life that would cause them to kind of delete
their existence and anything that would connect them to their previous reality and just take off across the countryside. And so the idea of this person with a blank slate who had something traumatic happen that he was not connected to, and where would he end up? And to me, the idea of him wandering into this small town in Kansas seemed appropriate, both in the sense that, you know, there's wide open spaces, and that's very, you know, symbolic of this kind of open mind, this open existence that he's trying to piece back together, and also the fact that it's right in the middle of the country, and he's, you know, kind of a man lost in the center of this this vast expanse. So that it kind of worked its way backwards. It kind of came out of the idea that, you know, I wanted to tell a story about a man who had had this traumatic experience and was trying to piece those memories together, and Kansas kind of became a seemingly natural place to set those stories.
Yeah, when you put something in, you know, when you take it thrillers and thing and suspense stories and you kind of move them out of big cities and you start putting them more in, you know, basically the heartland of America, and you pick, you know, Kansas, which is, you know, right in the middle of the country. I mean, you can't get much more middle than that, and you can't get, you know, kind of almost more rural. I mean, there's really no big cities in Kansas. You got Topeka and maybe Kansas City. So when you're kind of going along with all that, you're kind of having to write a different kind of suspense because you're losing a lot of the, you know, the big city, New York, San Francisco, L.A., Chicago kind of style. So how kind of when you're conceptualizing a book like Getty's Moon and then you pick a place like Kansas, how are you able to kind of write all that in there because it is so much different than, like I said, than like the bigger cities when you have a lot more moving parts going on?
Well, it requires a lot of, from, you know, to start from, it requires it's a little bit of a leap for me because I'm more of a city boy. I mean, I'm definitely suburbs, but I have grown up in California primarily. I was born in San Diego. So, you know, living in a place like Kansas is outside of my experience. So it becomes one of those situations where, okay, well, now I'm going to have to research this. I'm going to have to visit. I'm going to have to, you know, make sure that I do the diligence and the legwork to make this as an accurate as possible, representation of a small town. And, you know, it's interesting because you don't want to, you know, my thought is you don't want to be a cliche small town, but then you realize quite quickly that some of those cliches are cliches for a reason. And you don't want to also tell a story that's disingenuous to, the local population and people who would have, you know, lived and grown up there. And, you know, some of, you know, my biggest compliments are sitting down with people and them really wanting to talk about some of the things in the book and about the experience of growing up in the heartland. And I didn't grow up in the heartland. I don't have that experience. And
right.
But it's kind of a fun place to be. I mean, I had one situation where someone actually seemed to kind of hurt that I misled them and, you know, and, so, you know, I had to win back the trust a little bit. But, you know, that's what we do as writers. We can't always write exactly, you know. I mean, you hear the old trope of write what you know, and I take that more to mean write the personal experiences of what you know, because if you limit yourself to, you know, the places you've been, the things you've seen, the things you've experienced, it would, in most cases, I think, be a fairly narrow writing experience. So, you know, the humanity becomes what you know, and everything else becomes research.
Yeah, and I love the fact, you know, when you say that you have, when people go on Amazon, and here's the thing, when they look at it, I love the warning, as it says, this is a supernatural thriller and is meant for an adult audience, as it contains scenes that depict adult situations and graphic violence. I love that. That's what I love when I see, like, just, you know, supernatural thriller and horror stuff. That's the whole idea of the genre. It's not about sometimes cutesy this and that, you know, everything else. And you got some extremely great reviews. You have, you know, coming out of the gate. I mean, how was that feeling when you kind of wrote the end and then you kind of got it out there how nervous and then how gratifying was it to see how, you know, you were able to get some of those good early reviews because, you know, the book just came out a couple days ago. And so how was that for you? And how is
well,
it
Well, it's actually been out for over a year now. It came out last February.
Oh, okay. It was reintroduced. Okay, my fault.
Yeah, no problem at all. The you know, it's an interesting thing because it is my first, novel that I'm putting out to the public. And it's one of those things where it's part of you as a writer. I mean, it's impossible to, in my estimation at least, to separate, that part of you, from, the criticism when it comes is going to be personal because it's an extension of your personality. It's an extension of your being in a way. It's, you hear writers often refer to their books as their babies. And I think that's, while a little overwrought, it's entirely, inaccurate because it's, mm-hmm. One of the most personal things I've ever done to place that part of me out into the public, sphere for critique. So it's interesting. I mean, we definitely, I was working with some very talented people on the editing side and, people that were helping me with promotion. And we, kind of looked at, all right, well, if there's something here, let's kind of, take this step by step and, we did what we called a focus group. I guess it could be a beta read, but we didn't. We kind of approached it more from a product kind of angle, more like a what you would do for a movie coming out or anything like that. So we did that focus group, and the responses that we were getting back were so tremendously positive from people that it buoys your confidence a little bit, and it enables you to take that next step and say, all right, well, I'm going to send this out to a wider swath of people and see if the same kind of response continues. And then by the time that you put it out to the public, I don't know that you're ever necessarily really ready for that, but at least you've kind of gone through the, a softer kind of preliminary phase that's gotten you prepped for the fact that there's going to be positive, there's going to be people that love it, there's going to be people that hate it, and hopefully, the former outweigh the latter, and overall people are enjoying the book, enjoying the experience, and it seems to have been that way. And we got, as you well know, we got, fairly prominent name in your own magazine at the end of last year. So, as far as being one of the best of 2013, and that was, just incredibly gratifying because you start this really in a vacuum. You start telling a story that you want to read. You start writing characters that you want to know, and so when people are responding to them, that's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, because this is your debut novel, Getty's Moon, and again, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking with author John Mulhall, Mulhall. Go to johnmulhall.com for a lot more information. So this is your debut novel, and
yep.
A lot of people, with your debut novel, you kind of write about not just what you know, but kind of what you read. So is this kind of the kinds of books that you got interested in when you were a kid, when you started reading, and this is how you kind of started to formulate what you wanted to do when you decided that you wanted to write a book?
Interesting. I get, the story about influence or the question about influences a lot, and this is a little bit tangential to that. I find that I'm influenced. I find that what I tend to watch and love and read all kind of tends to be very, it's very broad. I mean, I do like a lot of genre films. I like, films that are in the good horror, of course, good suspense. I don't really go into hack and slash, blood and guts kind of stuff, but definitely sci-fi, fantasy. I'm drawn to all of those things. And I've read all those things. I was a huge fan of Ray Bradbury growing up, and definitely reading. But there was a wide wide group of people that I was reading, and it was no one genre in particular. So, but when I find that when I tend to want to pick up pick up a piece and write it myself, this is just kind of where I skew naturally, and I don't really think about it going in. It's just what appeals to me, what fires me up, and so that's what I write. So it's interesting that there are certain people I know that, hey, they write horror and they watch horror and they live horror, and that's kind of all it is. And for me, I look at it as I just have to write what those things that really kind of, you know, get under my skin and won't leave me alone and kind of persist until they're down on the page. So, and I try not to question the genre too much. I don't really overthink it, but it's definitely interesting that it's not exactly what I tend to watch or read solely, as a rule. So it's fascinating. And I'm sure that as I continue to write, the genres will kind of mush together, and they kind of even do in this book a little bit. One of my favorite reviews called it genre bending, and I love that because that appeals to me. I never really set out to write one specific thing. I just kind of like the idea of a world with supernatural elements and reviewing that world a little bit at a time.
Well, now, so give us a look at some of the other characters, not Tyler, some of the ones that maybe surprised you that you didn't realize would have as big of a voice as they did when you started out writing the book. Which kind of characters did you kind of fall in love with, and which ones did your fans fall in love with after reading the book?
I think the answer for both of those is the same character, and that's there's a section in the book where we go into the past of the main character, and we see a little bit of his childhood, and there are two friends that are with him, and one of those friends is named Rick. And Rick always kind of started off for me as being I knew who the character was, but I didn't have a particular affinity for the character. If I recollect my own childhood and my playmates, he'd be the one that I probably would be least close to, as I started to develop the book and his character and started to understand the things that really made him tick as a person, I found myself realizing that he was, in a way, the biggest hero of the book. And it surprised me to find myself so kind of in love with that character. And it's interesting because he, as far as other characters in the book, he doesn't get the most time on the page, most time on stage per se, but mm-hmm. He is he's definitely someone that when I have conversations with folks who finish the book and when I want to talk about it, he comes up in conversation quite a bit as being either a favorite character or a character they found most interesting and most developed. And it certainly didn't start off that way, and that's one of those happy, wonderful little things that happen as in the course of the writing as the characters take on their own existence and their voices become uniquely their own and they take over the writing from you a little bit. That's that's one of those happy accidents, and I love that, and I love Rick. So it's I'm writing the follow-up book now to Getty's Moon, and Rick is going to play a prominent part in that as people are, I'm probably not shocked to find out. So
that's kind of cool, isn't it, that when you find a character like that you had no idea would kind of move forward, that you kind of found, I guess you want to say maybe another friend. You kind of found somebody in your character, Rick, that now you're going to have, you're going to have move forward, that you had no idea that it was going to be like that at the beginning.
It's my absolute favorite thing, and I'm a writer that believes in outlines. I you know, I spent most of my adult life writing for corporate clients, and you know, there are certain methodologies that I've taken away from that I'm so happy to have. You know, the idea of deadlines and the idea of milestones and outlines and you know, it's kind of a structured approach to creativity. And I feel like when you do structure, your creativity thrives. If your outline is so constrictive that it doesn't allow a character like, you know, Rick in this instance to rise up and assert their independency and have their own voice, then it's too constrictive. And I feel like it was just enough that he was able to, in a way, skew certain aspects of the book, of the story, and rise up as an unlikely hero in some respects. And and that was exciting for me. That was, you know, it was an area where the outline starts to deviate, not from the, you know, from the primary journey, but just in the way that journey is traveled, the way that story is told.
Yeah, that's the one thing. And it's very sophisticated as more than a debut author, as I can hear, because I hear a lot of debut authors, and it's not like they really have a good handle or kind of around their characters or maybe around their book. They just kind of wrote something, and maybe it was a cutesy book or maybe it was this and that. But the handle that you have around your characters, around your story, and kind of know who you are is very refreshing. And I think that fans, as they read and kind of follow you along, will maybe get to know a little bit more about that. Is that something that you kind of, you know, wanted people to make sure that they understood that this was maybe a reflection of you within your first book?
You know, I really first and foremost just want people to enjoy the read. And that's, you know, I mean, I try to, as much as there is a massive reflection of me throughout elements of the book, throughout characters in the book, and, you know, throughout how I approach the book, I really just want people to enjoy themselves, because ultimately I feel like, you know, there's an element of, you know, if you write something that is you know, dense and unapproachable, and, you know, and it may be considered genius by some, but if it's you know, impenetrable by a reader, then I feel like in a way you failed, because ultimately, you know, the job is to write something that people can appreciate and enjoy and want more of. And so, you know, that's the first and primary mission I have, is just to make sure that the story is one that the writer would appreciate. And I put myself in that role. This is a book that I wrote that I would want to read. I would want to pick up this book and follow it along and have it resolve as it does, and I would feel satisfied with that. And hopefully in doing that and telling the story for myself, you know, that I'm also telling a story for other people. And, you know, it seems to be the case, and I'm very happy about that. But all the other stuff is wonderful, and I love to talk about it. I love to, you know, I love the press possibilities and being able to kind of, you know, talk about the insides and outsides of the process, and I, you know, I love that. But ultimately, the reader doesn't see that, you know, or shouldn't have to see that when they pick up the book, in my estimation, you know. So all that stuff is great, and, you know, we can talk about, you know, certain people I you know, sit down with, we talk about symbolism, when we talk about, you know, mm-hmm. the character names, and, you know, there's little fun, little hidden treasures that I think, you know, every author puts in because they want there to be a depth to their prose, to their storytelling, and, you know, the things all mean something in one way or another, and that's cool, but I hope that people don't have to know any of that about me or about, you know, the intricacies of what I'm hoping to put into the writing, you know, that they can just pick up the book and, you know, read it on a plane flight and go, wow, that was cool. I want more.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the fun things. And so when you're going through this process as a debut author, you have to learn, you know, a ton of lessons. And I think that now you can kind of see in your books, just like I said, the sophistication of those lessons that, you know, you have learned. So we got about 30 seconds left. So let, you know, kind of give us, you know, what you're going to be doing in the future and things that maybe people can find out about you and maybe interact with you a little bit more.
That's great. I have finished my second book. I finished it at the end of the last year, and it's just in editing right now. It's a shorter book. It started off life as what was supposed to be a novella, but I wrote a little bit beyond that. And so now it's a short novel that's called Dark and Broken Things, and it's going to be coming out probably in the next few months. And then I'm working on the follow-up to Getty's Moon right now, and as a few longer short stories that I'd like to put out there as well in some respect, even if it's just on the website. And that's really, you know, pretty much if people are interested, you know, come find me on the website. It's johnmulhall.com, and we have a newsletter, or at least sign up. So we're going to alert people of new releases and new happenings. We're looking at doing the audio version of Getty's Moon soon. So there's a few fun things on the horizon. I'm looking forward to it. And in the meantime, I'm just going to try to keep my head down, keep writing.
Well, John, we want to thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it, and we just can't wait to see what's coming out from you in the future, and we'll keep our eye out on you.
I appreciate it so much. I had a great time. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good one, John, and enjoy.
You too. Take care, John.
So, again, everybody, that is author John Mulhall, and his book is Getty's Moon, his debut book, and you can find him at johnmulhall.com, MULHALL.com. We have a couple more things to go over here, and also author L.J. Sellers returns with her latest Agent Dallas thriller in Trigger. You can buy Trigger wherever ebooks are sold, and you can visit L.J. on the web by going to L.J. Author Rick Reed has returned with Final Justice. It's the latest in his Jack Murphy series. Killing is a team sport, and to play the game, Jack Murphy has to identify all the players. So you can pick up Final Justice on Amazon today. We are going to be back now after this break, and we are going to be talking for the very first time to author Robin Cook, New York Times bestselling author of over, of course, 28 international bestsellers. People would know him from all the things that he's done, Coma, and his latest book is called Cell, another groundbreaking medical technology book that Robin is bringing to us, and actually just quite freaking scary when you just think about it. So, in the meantime, we will see you in a second, and here you go. So again, everyone, I want to welcome you back here to our last segment of Suspense Radio. We want to welcome thank John Land and John Mulhall for being on the show earlier. But now we want to translate into New York Times international best-selling author Robin Cook. First time I've ever been able to speak with Robin. It's such a great pleasure. Robin, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's nice to be on the show with you.
Yes, again. And so thank God we could have rescheduled this, because 2 weeks ago I was really like, oh, I was sweating. I'm like, oh, my gosh, now we're going to get him back on. And I'm so happy that you're able to read. Your latest book is Sell. And it brings in a couple different concepts that you have, because it goes on a lot of new technology with, you know, still the gripping kind of thriller that you have, you know, going on with like what you call top-notch fusion of groundbreaking medical science. So give us a little bit about the conception of Cell and you know, what it's about for fans who are just finding out that, because the book came out about a week ago. So give them a little bit about, you know, what Cell is.
Well, Cell is sort of, in a certain sense, a continuation of my previous book, Nano. I did a book on nanotechnology, and because of the research I did on that book, I woke up in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning in the summer, and I said, my gosh, I know what's going to happen. And the reason I did that is because I learned a lot about nanotechnology and how it's going to affect medicine. And I knew what was happening in informational technology, particularly with the smartphone platform. And I know what's going on with genomics. And all three of these technologies are, I call it a super convergence, and it's all happening at the same time. And the result is going to completely change medicine.
Oh.
So that was the stimulus for writing Cell. I like to introduce people to medical ideas and whatnot, but never have I dealt with an idea that is so, I think, mind-boggling and changing. I mean, medicine has essentially been somewhat the same since Hippocrates back in Greece, ancient Greece, and now suddenly we're on the brink and we're in the process. The change is already occurring.
Right. I can see it just by different kind of surgeries and things that they do and how much different it is, where, you know, now you have knee surgeries, you just get it, you get done, and you walk home, and you just do it, where before you're in hospital for a week.
But, you know, that's still the old-style medicine. That's sick care. What's coming and what people will understand when they read Cell is, instead of that sick care where you just kind of everybody waits until somebody gets sick and then they try to help them or relieve symptoms or hopefully cure them, because of these convergence of these technologies, we're going to switch from sick care to true health care. And that means and that means people will be in charge of their health care. I know that's a little bit scary to some people, because now they figure, well, the doctors are in charge, the hospital's in charge, the big pharma's in charge, all these stakeholders are kind of in charge, and they're kind of feel like, well, if I do get sick, they're all there waiting to help me. Well, some people might say, well, they're waiting to help you, but they're also victimizing you. But anyway, suddenly it's going to change, and the individual person, because of their smartphone and what that smartphone can do, is going to be in charge of their medical care in a way that's never been anticipated.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 43 years old, so the smartphone to me is more powerful than the first computer that I was teaching myself on how to be on computers. And I don't know if the younger generation actually realizes just how powerful of an instrument they have in their hand that can make phone calls, but everything else, because it is. It's just such a powerful device that for you to be able to incorporate it at what you called iDoc within the book
right.
Cell,
yep.
I mean, is really the scary concept to say that this could be going on. This is what's going the future is going to be for generations,
well,
who would have no idea about everything else.
It is going on, I can prove it, because if you get into a group of people and you ask them, how do you get your medical information. If you suddenly need some medical information, whether it's about your own circumstance or relatives or just pure interest, how do you get it? And everybody will say, well, I go online and I Google it or whatever their search engine is. And that is such a huge change because previous to this, everybody thought that they had to go to the medical profession to get their medical information. Suddenly,
right.
The medical profession is in the back seat of the car right now, and people are in the driver's seat, and they're in the driver's seat a lot more than they realize because as these apps are developed for the smartphone, already there's more than 50,000 health apps for the smartphone already. And it's going to be able to monitor all your vital signs, even your chemistries, your blood pressure, your EKG. It's going to be able to monitor that in real time, exactly. Right at the moment you look at your phone, it's going to be able to tell you all of those things. Those things that today you might, you know, gee, I wonder what my sugar level is. And you have to make an appointment, go to your doctor writes a prescription that you could go to the hospital, have your blood drawn, they send it to a lab. It could take weeks, it could take a month, and if it gets sort of lost and then nobody calls you, that's the reality, that's the past reality. The reality that is today is you'll be able to look on your smartphone, and your smartphone will be able to tell you your blood sugar right at that moment. But, you know, as great as that is, as you've already implied, that there is some scariness to it as
There's a lot of scariness. I mean, that's the thing about medical thrillers that you write, that you have been writing now for so many years, that the thing is that medical thrillers do, I mean, they encompass everyone in the world regardless of where you are. If you write one thriller that is going after the president or a political thriller, that's a very small amount of people that it's going to affect. What medical thrillers do, like what you write here in Cell, is it affects the world. There's not one person out there that this could not affect. And that's what makes it so scary, because it does affect everybody, not just a little bit of people, of terrorists or drug organizations and things like that.
You hit the nail on the head. I could not have said it any better. I mean, you know, you can read a thriller about a great white shark in the ocean, and you could shudder and say, okay, that's it. I'm not going in the ocean.
And that's what Jaws did.
Yeah, exactly. And but the books I write, because they're about real stuff, and I write stuff that the way medicine really is, and that's why it's so scary. That's why my first big bestseller, Coma, was particularly iconic, because prior to Coma, people had the idea that hospitals were a safe haven, that all doctors were great, and so they didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. People read Coma, they finished Coma, and all of a sudden they said, oh my gosh, the safe haven, the hospital, is not as safe as I thought it was, and you know, doctors are not all the same. There's some bad guys out there that nobody seems to be getting rid of. And that was the message, and that was the big message of Coma. And it changed people's perception about medicine. I'm convinced of all my books, Cell is going to change people's opinion about medicine even more.
Right, because it's written in the fact, it's written for, you know, the not just the 21st century, but the 22nd century. And that's what you're doing. It's more forward thinking.
But I don't want people to think that this is sort of some sort of science fiction futuristic book.
No, not at all.
This
not
is
at all.
Going on right now. And, you know, some people might say, well, here you have your cell phone. It's going to be your primary care doctor. Well, the FDA has to approve that, and they're never going to approve that. Well, I'll tell you right now, is that I'm sure that will be the FDA's initial reflex, because, as you know, about a couple of weeks ago, they tried to get rid of a startup that where you could get your genomic information. They said, perhaps people aren't prepared to have this. Maybe this is not such a good idea. This is even, you know, a quantum leap beyond that. So the FDA might, at least initially, but I'll tell you, it's going to overtake medicine like a tsunami, whether the FDA is going to be against it in the beginning. Every one of the stakeholders are going to be against it. The doctors are going to be against it because it's competition. The hospitals are going to be against it because it's going to reduce hospitalization. If you can monitor just as well at home, why be in the dangerous hospital environment where you might get one of those drug-resistant bugs because that's where they live? You can stay home and monitor yourself completely. The big pharma is going to be against it because the paradigm of drug-taking today is to take a drug that has been shown to, say, lower some laboratory value, like your cholesterol. But if you look at the evidence-based medicine associated with that, it might only lower the cholesterol significantly in as little as like 5% of people. So what does that do to the other 95%? It doesn't do anything. And yet the cost is there and all the side effects are there. With your cell phone being your primary care doctor, with your genomic information, which is what computers can do extremely well. In fact, they can do it better than real doctors. They'll know whether you're part of that 5% and if you should take that drug, or if you're part of the 95%, it will say, do not take this drug. So Big Pharma is going to be against it too.
Of course. They're against anything where they don't make money.
and the whole industry doing laboratory tests, medical laboratory tests, they're going to be against it because the phone will be able to do it essentially in real time. So,
and you know, the one thing that I think that readers need to understand, because just from interviewing you here for the last 12 minutes or so, you bring the medical profession to a place where a normal person like myself, who's never been to medical school, just knows the basic kind of thing, can understand what you're saying. And I know that you can really go over the top, and you could really start talking about medical science in a way that people might not get it and kind of maybe turned off. So when you're writing a book like Cell, and like you did with Nano and Death Benefit recently, how, you know, conscious of you or, you know, are you of your audience to make sure that you do leave it in those terminologies that people can understand and relate to?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think that's a very important question. Most people think that, oh, technology and medicine, I can't understand that stuff. It's so esoteric, et cetera. Well, I don't think it is, because the central concepts are not that esoteric. And if you're careful and if you think of your reader, one of the ways that I think of my reader is that when I write a scene, particularly a scene that might involve some medical technology or medical information of some sort, I let my wife read it, who is not a physician, and she's my biggest critic. And she'll say, I don't understand this. I don't understand this. And I'll say, what do you mean you don't understand it? It's so simple. It's right there. Look at this sentence. It's so simple. I don't understand it. And then, you know, I have to go, and then I rewrite it. So she has helped a lot in what you're talking about. But also just being cognizant of what, you know, you can't use – most doctors talk in almost a patois. And it's, in some sense, it's defensive. You know, they talk in a way so that to keep people from understanding specifically, because then that if they understand a lot, then they'll ask too many questions.
Right.
So in some respects, it's a way that you can kind of bully patients. And all of us in medicine know that we can do that. I've always tried to avoid that. I went into medicine because I thought that this was a very altruistic profession, et cetera. And I was a little bit disturbed by the fact that it had become such a business. And that's what stimulated me to write my first book, because I wanted people to understand that their image of the medical profession and the reality was quite different. Same with the way it was projected on in terms of books and TVs and the shows and all that kind of stuff, like Dr. Marcus Welby, MD. Everything was great.
Right.
But then Coma came out, and that marked a change in the way medicine has been depicted on television. I mean, today you watch doctor shows, and there's some warts now. There was never, before Coma, there was never any warts. Everything was perfectly fine. Dr. Ben Casey was a great guy. And, I mean, you know, there's still plenty of doctors like that, and there's plenty of great hospitals. But the reality is that there's some really bad ones in both doctors and hospitals. And the fact that I think that's something that the public should know about. So anyway,
yeah,
I've wandered a bit.
That's
but
okay.
Your question about or the idea that when I write these books, I have to write it so that it's understandable, and not so that you have to kind of figure it out, so that it doesn't get in the way of the thriller or mystery aspect of
right.
the storytelling. And yet I like people to feel like they're in that area. Say I take them into a medical examiner's office and in an autopsy room. I like to write it so that people really think that they're there, or if it's in an operating room, that, you know. So I really make an effort to create that kind of sense in people's minds so that their creativity can fill in all the voids, and so that they have a sense of what it's like. What is it like to be in an operating room? What is it like you're in an operating room, everything's going fine, and all of a sudden everything goes bad? Sometimes you don't even know why it happens and what happens under those circumstances. And it's really, if you are careful the way you write, you can really create that, and then people will fill in the blanks and they'll get sort of a sense. Their pulse will pick up. I mean, when you're a surgeon and suddenly something goes wrong, and which can happen, I mean, you know, your pulse goes up and you go, oh my God, you know, what is this? And suddenly there's this great anxiety, but it's your presence of mind, your training, everything has to go in, because that's when your training really counts. To do an operation right and everything goes right, I've always said you can train a orangutan to do that. Where it really counts is when it goes bad. And it's not always something that you did. I mean, I would say it would be sort of like flying an airplane. And, you know, it's very routine, you know, everything, the computer's doing a whole bunch of stuff, and the plane's coming in, you're the pilot, everything is fine, everything. And all of a sudden one of the engines goes out. Or both, right? You know, with that plane
right.
that landed in the East River. Boy, oh boy, that's when that individual, that pilot and that co-pilot, I mean, they switch. That's like when you're doing surgery and all of a sudden the aorta breaks and all of a sudden blood squirts out and you go, oh my God, how did that break? You know, and you have to go into this mode to know what to do, and you don't have a lot of time to think about it. And so that's what I try to do with my novels. I try to take people into, so that they know, they have a sense of what it's like to be in that environment.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with number one New York Times bestselling author Robin Cook, and his latest book is called Sell, which is available now wherever you can find books. You're going to find this book. And that, the one thing you said that was so telling to me was, you don't know what's going on in an operating room because, of course, unless you're a doctor, we're asleep when we're in there. And I guess the scary thing is that, you know, we're signing away saying, yes, we understand all, you know, everything that, you know, that can happen. And a lot of people don't even read it. They're like, yeah, 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 okay, whatever, just sign. But then when all hell does break loose, you have no idea what's going on. But now that when they read a Robin Cook book and they're under anesthetic and they just get that sense at the very last time, like, am I going to wake up? That's what you have done to me when I, because the first book I read of you was Brain, and I actually listened to it on audio. You scared me to say, now if I fall asleep, am I going to wake up? And I think
well,
that's more
scary. It gives you a lot more respect for the anesthesiologist.
Oh, it does. Because to me, that's more scary than a plane ride going down, because I can see it, I can feel it, I can hear it, I can do whatever I got to do. But if I'm under sleeping and I'm in a hospital room, I have no idea. No idea what's going on behind me.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And in fact, with my book Coma, again, that was one of the major roles that I wanted that book to play. Because I was a surgeon myself, and often when it came time to talk about actually having surgery with a patient, their first response was, I want to be asleep. And I would say, well, you know, we're doing this procedure. It's on your leg or your foot or something. You know, it would be a lot better to use kind of local anesthesia or spinal anesthesia or something like that. No, I want to be asleep. And you say, well, you know, it's not as dangerous. No, I want to be asleep. Well, one of the reasons I wrote Coma is that when people read Coma, everybody had a lot more respect for the anesthesiologist.
And, hell yeah, you do.
and you know, the metaphor of going to sleep, that's what doctors originally said to people. You know, we're going to put you to sleep, blah, blah, blah. They haven't put you to sleep. That's a comforting metaphor, whereas in actuality, what happens is that you're essentially poisoned to near death and then saved. That's really...
Thanks for just scaring the hell out of me again.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's reality.
But that's true. It's true.
It is true, and it's better for you to... It's better. Maybe it is scary, but it's better for you to know that, because if you have a choice in a circumstance between general anesthesia and local anesthesia, you can be made to be, you know, very comfortable. You won't feel it and everything else, and you will actually go to sleep. But then you're actually asleep. If you're just sedated enough to actually fall asleep, that's different than being poisoned by these anesthetic gases so that your brain doesn't function right. And then given a paralytic drug, which is what the Amazon natives shoot in their blowguns to paralyze people, that's what you get also. So you can't breathe.
Oh, my Lord.
It works phenomenally well, and it is very safe in good hands. When you're in a good hospital who normally have good doctors, it's extremely safe and really works. I mean, when you have to have general anesthesia, you know, for operation on your chest or your thyroid or something like this where you can't use a spinal or something, it's extremely safe, and people are very good at it. And but, you know, you're taking a little bit more of a risk. But I think that's the kind of information that people should have.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, we got about a minute left here in the show, so I want to just have you tell everybody, besides going to robincook.com, where else can maybe people interact with you, find out a lot more information if you're going to be on the road, where else they can maybe hear you talk about, you know, different kinds of subjects?
Well, I do have an op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal, along with a wonderful doctor from California. He and I wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. You learned something there. I do have a Facebook page that I do postings on, and which has quite a few people who seem to look at that, and I've been posting on that, and... And I do have my own website, but I'm busy writing my next book.
Yeah. See, I mean, even from Coma to today, you never had Facebook, you never had email, you never had this great interaction from fans like you do now. So everything is changing just for writers and how you have to go, you know, from beyond. So Sell is just the perfect kind of, you know, book to kind of take you now more into the future, and it's great that you know keep writing, because I'll tell you, after international bestsellers, I love that you still have the motivation to keep wanting to pound these things out, because fans and like myself just love to keep reading them.
Well, I'm lucky because medicine is changing so quickly that I have so many things to write about. If
That's
I was
good.
Doing this 50 years ago, I think I would have run out of things to write about.
You'd be writing those political thrillers then.
Right.
Well, Robin, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been an absolute pleasure to be able to speak with you. Look forward to maybe seeing you sometime in the future if you're going to be at Thriller Fest or VoucherCon or some of these events that, you know, we are at. It would be great to just shake your hand and say, you know, thank you so much for all the great entertainment that you've given me and so many other fans.
When I am at those types of venues, I encourage people to come up and chat with me, and I love to sign books and chat with people and find out which books they liked and why. I mean, it's fun to get some definite feedback.
It is. Yeah, and you get that a lot now, like on your Facebook page and things like that. You're able to get that instantaneous feedback right after they read sell, where before you couldn't. So I guess that's a good thing, too. Even if it's negative, it's still feedback.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, Robin. Well, thank you. You have a fabulous day, and you know we will talk with you later in the future.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is New York Times, number one New York Times best-selling author, Robin Cook. You can probably call him the godfather of medical thrillers, starting with Coma way back when and coming now back up to his latest book, Cell. And that is available now. Go to robincook.com for more information. You can buy the books wherever they're sold. In every format you can have them in, they are there. And we want to thank him so much for coming on and speaking about it. We have some new schedules coming out. We are going to be taking some breaks here coming up in the next future or so. So in the future, check out our website, suspensemagazine.com. See what we have going on. Check all the great shows we have. You know, Climate Science Radio with Doug Lyle and Jan Burke hosting. We now have Stranger Than Fiction with Donald Allen Kurtz. So we have a lot of things that we have going on. We encourage everyone to check out Suspense Magazine. Go to ITW for the writing online writing school they have going on now and everything else. So we want to thank everybody. Enjoy. We'll see you on a couple weeks. So until then, goodbye and keep reading.